This afternoon I'm going to offer some reflections on our theme of becoming wholly human and teasing out perhaps some of the implications of what it means to care. If, as I think the metaphor of the elephant's footprints suggests, that care is the overarching framework for our practice, for what we do when we try to be more mindful in meditation, we try to live a life that's more benevolent and compassionate, when we seek to live life ethically, then presumably the result or the goal of such a life would somehow likewise correspond to a caring way of being. And in some ways, this comes into conflict with the ways in which the Buddhist tradition has often presented its idea of the goal of the practice. And this usually comes under the heading of the word enlightenment, which is quite familiar, I'm sure, to most of you who have studied anything to do with Buddhism. I actually prefer the word awakening to represent this, but in either case, I suspect that for some of us, maybe all of us, the idea of being awake or being enlightened means that we've somehow come to see things as they really are. An expression that once again is found right through the early canonical texts, to see things as they really are. And this gives the idea that the enlightened person or the awake person is someone who has a sort of detached, calm, clear attitude, understanding on life, in which that person sees things as they really are. They're no longer suffering from the habitual confusions and delusions and ignorance that besets most of us. And all of this suggests very much that the root of the problem, the reason we're not awake or enlightened, is that we've somehow got reality wrong. We've made some kind of deep cognitive mistake. We're ignorant, we're deluded. Instead of realizing that everything is without a self, we're convinced that there is a self at the core of things. Instead of realizing that everything is impermanent, we're somehow fixated on the notion of something that doesn't change, that is fixed, that can be somehow held on to for security. Instead of seeing things as tragic, unreliable, suffering, we like to think that somewhere out there or in here, there is a place where we can be happy, we can be eternally at peace. And this perspective, in terms of the kind of images that the tradition provides, is expressed through the figure of the seated Buddha beneath the tree. It's represented also just in the way that a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun may project him or herself in the public sphere, again, as someone who is somehow not really involved in the cut and thrust of working in the world, but has that sort of renunciation, that detachment, that often a sort of a serene, wise attention to things that is grounded in the fact that they've come to see things as they really are. So to me, there is a conflict here. on the one hand, the Buddha's last words, to tread the path with care. Care is this overarching framework for how do we live our lives. A practice, first and foremost. And on the other hand, this idea of enlightenment or awakening, which is somehow, at some level, a bit remote from caring, and rather more a quality of knowing, a quality of knowing how things are. Now, this gives rise, I think, to a distinction that we also find in Western thought. In fact, I think it was first coined by the American philosopher John Dewey, who was one of the leading figures of the pragmatist movement, who made a distinction between knowing that and knowing how. They both include the word knowing, but knowing that has to do with knowing that things are impermanent and dukkha and selfless in Buddhist terminology, as opposed to knowing how, which is far more about the acquisition of a kind of skill. So is awakening, enlightenment, the goal that we might be aspiring to, the optimal condition of knowing what is the case, what is truth, what is real, what is, if you wish, as opposed to having achieved a certain know-how, a savoir-faire, having become skilled in the art of living? Is the awakened being one who is awakened because they've found a way to live skillfully and appropriately and caringly in the world? Or is it about gaining some definitive insight into the nature of ultimate truth or reality? I think the Buddha addresses this question in the famous parable of the arrow. And just briefly, I'll remind you of that. The story goes of a person who is severely wounded by a poisoned arrow and is lying on the ground, bleeding to death. But he refuses that his friends bring a doctor to treat him until he knows the name of the person who shot the arrow. He knows whether the bow was a longbow or a crossbow, in which he knows whether the feathers on the shaft of the arrow were those of a peacock or a crow or a stork or an eagle. In other words, the person will not engage with the treatment or the practice until he knows what is the case with his situation, and knowing that. And in fact, the Buddha teases this out to the point of absurdity, and then says, well, one could know all of those things, but meanwhile, the person would die. In other words, you could spend an awful lot of time getting this information, and in the meantime, you bleed to death. And when he explains this parable, he says it's like someone who says, I will not practice the Dharma until I know whether the world is beginningless or endless, finite or infinite, whether the mind and the body are the same, whether the mind and the body are different, whether the awakened person exists after death or doesn't exist after death, or both or neither. In other words, until we get the answers to what is the case with reality, and again, these are just examples of certain views, opinions, or beliefs, we would spend the rest of our lives struggling with these difficult questions, and would never actually get round to putting the Dharma into practice. So the person who is preoccupied with knowing how things are is in a sense like the person who is preoccupied of knowing, you know, who shot the arrow, the kind of bow, the kind of arrow, and so on. And in both cases, never gets round to doing what actually might make a difference. Now, to me, this again supports the idea that what the Buddha is concerned with is not a knowing that this is the nature of reality, but a knowing how to extract the arrow. And in fact, in one sutta, he describes this in extreme detail, how it requires that we apply intelligence or wisdom, we apply mindfulness, which are compared to the different surgical instruments used by a doctor to get the arrowhead out of the body, to remove and clean the wound from poison. And then he goes into all of these details about how we should then treat and care for the wound in order for it to heal properly, and so on and so forth, which is a very good example of how this practice is primarily therapeutic exercise. And it's only by applying this therapy, by healing ourselves, healing the soul, that we can then recover our strength, our integrity, our health, and then can lead a flourishing life. In other words, the purpose of removing the arrow is not just to remove the arrow. The purpose of removing the arrow is in order to get well again. That's the real goal. Now, in the early texts, the arrow is described as a tanha, usually translated as craving, and I would translate it rather more loosely as reactivity. Now, if we look then at the definition of how the Buddha understands nirvana he describes as the absence of reactivity, the removal of reactivity, the removal of craving. And craving, although it's very much biased towards desire and grasping and so on, is actually shorthand for greed and hatred and delusion, which are called the three fires. And I think this is, again, a suggestion that that craving is really a way of talking about deeply seated reactive patterns. In other words, when, as a human being, we encounter an environment, we are either attracted to it, we either are repelled by it, or we are confused by it. We don't know what it is. And these reactions, these reactivities, are triggered as soon as we encounter that situation. They arise in the same way as a flame will arise when a match strikes the matchbox and flares up. Now, there's a number of things that are, I think, worth thinking about here. One is that this is an entirely naturalistic process. It's not that we are somehow being immoral if we experience hatred or anger or attachment or lust or whatever it might be. But this is simply what happens when the kind of organism that we are, that has evolved over all of these millions of years, encounters the kind of environment it finds itself in, it triggers these reactions, this reactivity. And in this sense, nirvana is that non-reactive space that is freed from being overwhelmed or taken over by or driven by these reactive patterns. And so nirvana is described as the absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of confusion, or the absence of reactivity. And that is, in a way, the very core, the very heart of how we would then begin to attend to the world, maybe with care, with tenderness, with attention, in a way that's not driven by these reactive patterns. So So there's a clear polarity here between reactivity on the one hand and nirvana on the other, the nirvana being the possibility that can occur for all of us to be non-reactive. And as I mentioned this morning to that question about jealousy, this doesn't mean that we can only experience a non-reactive awareness when all of the reactions are literally dispelled. But we can be non-reactively aware of being reactive. We can be present to anger or fear or whatever it is, spontaneously being triggered by our encounter with the environment, but we do not have to buy into that. We can see it as just the consequence of conditions. We can observe these reactions arise. If we simply notice them as transient, conditional play of the mind, then by their own accord, they will, over time, simply burn themselves out, and they will cease. And in the moment of their ceasing, then we gain a glimpse of nirvana itself. So nirvana is this capacity to be aware of these things non-reactively, which is essentially what mindfulness is all about, whether we use it in a Buddhist frame or whether we use it in MBSR or MBCT frame. It's basically the same practice. It's learning how to stop, be still, and look and observe what is going on and not getting caught up in it. Just seeing it for the play of conditions that will die down of its own accord if it's not further fueled. Now, I don't think any of us have probably got much difficulty with the idea of greed or hatred. We know when we experience forms of attachment or grasping or longing or different kinds of desire. This is something very palpable and immediate and something we know in our flesh. We know what it feels like to be attracted to something. Compulsively, passionately, uncontrollably at times, whether it's an object, whether it's a food, whether it's another person, whatever it might be. We also know the opposite of that. We know what it's like to be aversive. We know what it's like to suddenly say, I can't stand that. That's horrible. Go away. I hate that. It's also tinged very often with fear, with anxiety. And it's something that, again, just rises up within us. But what about the third one, which is usually translated as delusion or confusion? Moha is the word in Pali. This is a term that is almost invariably presented as part of this triad. These three fires or these three poisons, greed, hatred, delusion. Now, greed and hatred, I don't think we have much difficulty with, but what do we mean by delusion? What do we mean by confusion? If it is, like the others, an instinctive, reactive response to what's happening in our lives, then surely it should be equally evident to us in our practice, in our awareness. But delusion is generally presented as a failure to know how things really are. Delusion is overcome by paying attention to impermanence, to dukkha, to anatta, in order that we can free ourselves from these distortions or misperceptions or confusions, and in doing so, come to experience the world as it really is. Now, that's all very well, and that's all very Orthodox Buddhism, but it somehow doesn't help, or doesn't help me very much, in understanding how this is a reactive pattern as fundamental and as basic as the reactive pattern of greed or hatred. It seems much more abstract and remote. And I don't know about you, but when I'm sitting in meditation, and let's say in those rare moments where the attraction, aversion thing is not going on, I'm actually relatively, you know, it's okay, more or less chilled. What's it like for the delusion to arise? I don't, to be quite honest, find myself saying, oh, wow, everything's permanent. Oh, wow, it's all so happy. Oh, wow, it's all me. We don't instinctively and naturally find ourselves indulging in those what are effectively philosophical points. It doesn't quite work. And there's a lot of confusion in Buddhism about confusion. I think there's a lot of delusion about delusion. It's very difficult to know what it means. But I would rather take my cue here, not from Buddhist orthodoxy. We do not, by the way, find in the suttas a clear account of what moha means at all. There's no definition provided. When we get to the later traditions, the Abhidhamma and other texts, then we get basically the analysis of philosophical error, as I described. But experientially, what does it mean? Experientially, when you're sitting in meditation, when you're going about your life from moment to moment, what does it mean to be deluded or confused? Now, get a bit of a clue from looking at the etymology of the word. Moha means something like darkness or fog. In Tibetan, it's dibuk, which means a kind of fogginess of mind, a darkness of mind. And of course, we could understand this as being a condition under which it's very difficult to see things as they are, because I'm foggy and dark and muddled. That's quite okay. But again, that's not really something that I feel very strongly as an emotional reaction to experience. What I find myself confused about in meditation or in daily life is not the nature of reality, but the question or the problem of what to do. I don't know about you, but I spend a fair bit of time in meditation agonizing over, should I say this or should I say that? When I get home and meet my wife and I've got this problem I have to share, how do I present this? Questions are basically about how to live. What is the right thing to do? What is the wrong thing to do? We dwell again and again on things we've said and things we've done and feel that we probably didn't get it right. At times we might obviously feel that we did get it right, we are quite pleased with ourselves, but a lot of the time, and I think this is what often bedevils us when introspectively reflecting on our experience, is this endless kind of anguish around how to live, what to think, what to say, what to do. That's where I experience moha, blindness. In German, I was teaching in Germany recently, and they translate moha with this word, Verblendung. Verblendung. We don't really have an equivalent in English, but it's connected to the idea of being blind, blinded. And curiously, or maybe not so curiously, if you think of the Tibetan Buddhist wheel of life, you know, the six realms of existence, in the middle of which you have the driving force of greed, hatred, delusion, which are represented as a snake, a cockerel, and a pig. And then on the outer rim, you have the 12 links of dependent origination, which purportedly describe how suffering comes into being and how one can then free oneself from it. I'm not going to go into the details of that. But what's interesting is the image, the picture, that is used to represent ignorance, avijja. It's more or less synonymous with moha. The image that's used to represent ignorance, which is the first of the 12 links, is that of an old person who is blind walking with a stick. Now, often I find that the images we find in iconography are as telling as the definitions that we find in the scholarly texts. This blindness is, for me, more of a moral or ethical blindness. If you think of the blind person with a stick as depicted in this image, it's of a person who doesn't quite know the way, who can't orient him or herself to the surroundings. It's not a failure to know reality as it is. It's a failure to be able to get about in the world. At least that's how the metaphor is used. So, in this sense, moha, or delusion, or confusion, is not so much a failure to know what is the case with reality, but it's more a question of a failure to know what to do. So in other words, this, I feel, somehow strengthens the idea that the Dharma, or the Buddhist teaching, or the practice of the Dharma, is essentially something ethical. And this is, again, I feel, supported by this primacy of the notion of care. A person who is committed to care is not committed to knowing the nature of reality. That's almost a secondary issue. The real issue is, how do I care for my soul? How do I care for the other person? How do I care for the world? How do I care for life? This has got nothing to do with metaphysics or ontology. It has to do primarily with, how do I respond appropriately to the suffering of the world? It's an ethical question. It's a know-how, not a know-that. There are passages in the early canon where nirvana is presented as an ethical condition. Let me just read you a text. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. And the Buddha is speaking to a Brahmin called Jangusoni, who has asked him what he means when he says that Nirvana, or the Dharma, is clearly visible. This is, again, a famous, probably very old text in which the Buddha describes the Dharma as clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, and personally sensed by the wise. And in some passages, instead of the Dharma, he says Nirvana is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, to be clearly experienced by, to be experienced personally by the wise. So in answer to Jangusoni, the Buddha says, a person who has let go of tanha, or craving or reactivity, quote, neither plans for his own harm, nor for the harm of others, nor for the harm of both. And he does not experience in his mind suffering and grief. In this way, Brahmin, nirvana is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, and personally experienced by the wise. So nirvana, this non-reactive space, is an ethical space. It's a space where you neither plan for your own harm, nor the harm of others, nor the harm of both. And it's also a space that is still, peaceful, at ease. And it's the space from which we can learn to live in the world in a caring way, rather than in a reactive way. So nirvana, therefore, is the kind of, to use T.S. Eliot's expression, the still point of the turning world. And I think in some senses it's like the hinge of the path. It's the point on which one's life can turn from a life governed by habit, reactivity, fear, hatred, delusion, and so on, to a life that is no longer determined or governed by those things. The Buddha uses another term as a synonym for nirvana, defines it in exactly the same way, and that is a term called asankata, unconditioned. So the nirvanic perspective is an ethical perspective on life that is not determined or conditioned, i.e. unconditioned, by greed, by hatred, and by this moral confusion, let's say. It doesn't mean the unconditioned as a kind of ultimate truth or reality that somehow is beyond or somehow transcends the world, which is often how it's presented. The unconditioned, nirvana, capital U, capital N, some sort of ultimate reality, getting close to something like God. The Buddha here and elsewhere describes unconditioned and nirvana as an opening, a space of non-reactivity from which we can engage with life in a totally new way. Now, I have a funny feeling that the Buddha was already aware that his teaching was probably going to be interpreted not as an ethical practice, but as a metaphysical conviction. In other words, a set of teachings that describe to us what is actually true and real. And perhaps this is suggested in another parable, which is the parable of the snake. Suppose a man needed a snake and sought out a snake and wandered in search of a snake. And he saw a large snake and he grasped its coils or its tail. The snake would turn back on him and bite his hand or arm or one of its limbs, his limbs, and because of that he would die or suffer greatly. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, he says, some misguided people learn the Dharma, and having learned the Dharma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with discernment. They do not gain a reflective understanding of them. Instead, they learn the Dharma only for the sake of criticizing others and winning in debates. And they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learned the Dharma. These teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. So the Dharma, if you mishandle it in the way that you might mishandle a poisonous snake, will actually turn back on you and cause you more damage than it does good. Again, it's a beautiful metaphor. I think is quite profound, actually. But again, the Buddha doesn't, he only gives us clues as to what it might mean. But to me, the clearest clue is if the people who somehow use the Dharma as a way of establishing effectively a philosophical position, a dogmatic view, they form opinions, and then they get into endless disputes with people who have different views and different opinions and different beliefs, they will miss the point of what the Dharma was actually intended to do. And they, as he says, they do not experience the good for which, for the sake of which they learn the Dharma. Now, I will suggest that the mishandling of the Dharma is a bit like treating it as a description of reality rather than as a prescription for living. In other words, as a way of knowing that, as opposed to knowing how. Acquiring a set of views and opinions and beliefs about the nature of reality, rather than acquiring a set of moral and ethical and contemplative skills that enable us to respond to the suffering of the world in a more appropriate way. If we do consider it this way, then all of this discussion and debate that we find still with us today, Buddhist groups are unfortunately often as opinionated and sectarian as any other religious group. If you question certain sacred cows, like reincarnation, for example, you get into serious trouble. If you, challenge certain received opinions as to what constitutes the orthodox view, you're often rejected as some kind of heretic or some deluded person, and that often threatens your very viability as an active member of that community. It's required that you believe certain things. And again, I don't think this is remotely a Buddhist problem. We see it everywhere in the world, whether it's in the field of religion or the field of politics. However well-intended these philosophies and political systems might have started out as forces for good in the world, very easily they turn into rather inflexible systems of opinion and belief. And that then becomes the defining mark as to whether you are a good Buddhist or Marxist or Christian or liberal or whatever it might be. It's the view you hold of the world. Now, I feel that one of the things that is most distinctive and radical in the Buddha's teaching is that he rejects that whole approach. That whether the world is impermanent or permanent or dukkha or sukha, in the end doesn't really matter. What matters is how you respond to that world in your thoughts, in your words, in your deeds. In other words, it's about how to live, how to be wholly human, if you wish, rather than arriving at the truth, the ultimate truth. All Buddhist traditions, without exception, are very committed to the idea of ultimate truth, as opposed to conventional or relative truth. Now, these are ideas that simply don't occur in the early discourses, not once. It's a totally alien way of thinking in the Pali Canon. And yet it has become probably at quite an early stage in the development of Buddhism, it's become a bedrock of what it means to understand the Dharma. You have to know what is ultimately true as opposed to what is merely conventionally true. I think that totally misses the point. And the same can be said of the four noble truths. Again, my hunch is, and it's backed up with some scholarly work on analysis of the early texts, that the idea of noble truth was probably introduced at a later date. That what started out, in fact, as a set of ethical injunctions to fully know suffering, to let go of reactivity, to experience the non-reactive space of nirvana, and then to cultivate the Eightfold Path, became a set of dogmatic propositions. Life is suffering, the origin of suffering is craving, and so on. Again, I've written a lot about this, so I'm not going to get into it here. But it all comes down to the same point, namely that what matters is not some correct description of the nature of existence or reality or being. What matters is how we respond to the condition of life we find ourselves in as individuals whose lives are embedded in relationships with others, all of whom are sensitive, suffering organisms capable of pleasure and pain and fulfillment and meaninglessness and sadness and joy. This is where the practice takes place. All other considerations are at best secondary. And this leads us, I think, to what I already mentioned this morning, an ethics of care. Maybe just a couple of words about care. The word in Pali is apamada. And none of the translations into English, even the translations into Tibetan and other Asian languages, capture something rather crucial about the word, namely that it is a negative. It's a, not pamada. And pamada means drunken or intoxicated. The literal meaning of the word we're translating here as care means unintoxicated, an unintoxicated state, an undrunken state, a state of not being drunk or intoxicated, a state basically of not being out of control, which implies a state of somehow having achieved a kind of integrity within oneself whereby one has some sort of moral strength or ethical character that gives you a foundation for resisting the impulses of fear and hatred and craving and so on, and can keep you focused more single-pointedly on realizing your goals. Another suggestion as to how we might unpack this notion of care is looking at a very old Buddhist doctrine, which is that of the three roots of virtue. The three roots of virtue. Now, in all of the traditions, these three roots of virtue are described in the same way. They are alobha, adosa, amoha. The absence of greed, the absence of hatred, the absence of moha, confusion. Now, the difficulty here for us is that it suggests that once those things are gone, then, you know, you have, let's say, the freedom to, you know, act in a way that's not determined by them. But the way the privative or the negative is used in some of these languages is not to suggest the absence of, but the opposite of. So aloba, non-greed, doesn't just mean the absence of greed. It means equanimity. It suggests contentment. It suggests possibly generosity. the absence of dosa, of hatred, suggests compassion, love, tolerance. And the absence of moha, confusion, suggests intelligence, clarity, and, as I've suggested already, ethical or moral intelligence and clarity, not ontological clarity or metaphysical clarity, but ethical clarity. Now, that doesn't mean that you always know what is the right thing to do, but you've trained your ethical intelligence according to experience, according to the values that you aspire to, in such a way that you've got some sort of, you've cultivated a kind of ethical compass within you through your practice. And these are what the Buddha calls the three roots of virtue. So nirvana, which is, again, classically defined as absence of greed, absence of hatred, absence of confusion, is in fact equivalent to the three roots of virtue. So once again, this affirms the idea that nirvana is not some transcendent mystical state, but it is actually the non-reactive space that can open up within us when this reactivity dies down, or when we're able to hold a certain distance to it. But at the same time, as suggested here, it's also an opening to other moral and ethical possibilities that are hindered or blocked by greed and hatred and confusion. And those other ethical possibilities are, as we've just said, equanimity, generosity, love, tolerance, and moral or ethical intelligence and clarity. Now, I find this a rather persuasive argument, but then I would, wouldn't I, that that once again pointing quite essentially to practice of Dharma as an ethical behavior, as an ethical, as a way of an ethical life. And that's where I'm going to leave it today. I hope that's been helpful. We can have time later in the afternoon. We'll conclude with a period of discussion. But I would suggest now that we go back to the silence, we go back to the meditation, and meet back here at 3:15.